Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Diane and Steve, I am delighted that you're my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We've had a few minutes to sort of catch up before we hit the record button. Sounds like you all as a chapter have been very busy, and we're going to dive into the sort of the experiences that you all have had and maybe hear a little bit about what you're thinking going forward as an AFP chapter and as a community and a broader community. But before we do that, why don't we just let you introduce yourselves. Diane, why don't you just start?
Sure. Thanks, Jason. And thanks for inviting me to be part of this. So my name is Diane Bullius. I am involved in the AFP Greater Detroit chapter as immediate past president. And I am also the director of development for the College of Arts, Science, and Letters at the University of Michigan, Dearborn.
Hi, Jason. Really glad to join you today. My name is Steve Reagan, and I'm the president of the Greater Detroit chapter of the Association of Fundraising Professionals. And I also am the executive vice president of Hope Network here in Michigan.
Well, cool. Diane, you know, we were all planning on seeing each other. I was really looking forward to getting up to Detroit here. I think that was back in the fall, spring, and COVID-19 sort of came in and canceled a lot of things for us, but perhaps I'll get up there in early 2021 or sometime we'll get up there. But in the meantime, we will communicate and catch up here on the podcast. Diane, Steve, I'm really interested in sort of hearing what the last sort of 6 months has really looked like for you, both professionally and as a chapter. And so I'm just going to really follow your lead. Diane, Steve, I'm not going to tell you who has to sort of kick it off, but I think there's enough that you can share that we could really enjoy this conversation.
Great. Thank you. Steve, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, Jason, I think as a chapter, the pandemic has, it's of course, I think, surprised and challenged all of us. Here in Detroit, if you may recall, we were one of the early cities to be hit hard by the pandemic in its earliest days. New York, followed by Detroit and New Orleans, were for that first period, were the three hardest hit large urban areas. And we, I had lived and worked in New Orleans and still did a lot of work with nonprofits there, and also had strong relationships with fundraisers from my work in New York. So we began, I think we realized early on, you know, how serious this was for the nonprofit sector, and we pivoted very quickly to online programs. In the beginning, they were primarily just town halls or roundtables, a chance for people to talk casually, to share ideas, and even to talk about things as simple as canceling fundraisers and comparing schedules. But over time, we began developing, you know, more focused programming to help each other. And it was really an interesting experience. We went from having about 400 people a year participate in our programs to nearly 4,000 in just a few months. And many more listened to the recordings of the programs online. It was just an incredibly heartwarming response to see fundraisers come together and help each other, sharing information, you know, technical information about how to apply for the PPP program or lend, you know, even, you know, make share PPE equipment, you know, personal protection equipment between organizations. So it was a really great experience. And over time, we sort of realized that all of these conversations had led to, I think, some sort of important lessons and themes. And we also did some really unique things, like we hosted a joint webinar with the chapters from New York and New Orleans at sort of as we were all at our peak of impact by COVID. And we've stayed in touch since then and sort of watched how our communities have responded and our efforts at reopening. And we pulled together a panel with all of the fundraising chapters across the state of Michigan. So I think we learned some really unique lessons, but most importantly, I think, we saw how fundraisers and nonprofits come together and what an incredible, role we've played both in the response to the pandemic as well as to, the recent, social and racial challenges we're facing as a community and nation.
Yes. And it really, because we brought so many people together and we continue to do that, we really got to hear from a broad range of people. And as Steve said, there are these themes that came out of lessons learned during the conversations that were being held among the people that were participating. So, Steve, do you want to start with one of the first ones that we...
Yeah, what sort of that's remarkable to hear that you folks collaborated with. I did. I think I shared with you before we hit the record button. I did some collaboration with the podcasting. But what is a conversation? So yes, I understand that Detroit was hit hard by this. But what is a conversation when you've got Detroit, New York City, and you said New Orleans together? What does that look like? What's being discussed there?
Well, it was really interesting. I mean, although we were all three still getting hit very hard, we were all at sort of slightly different stages. New York was beginning to see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Detroit and New Orleans were sort of still right in the midst of it. And, you know, so we all, I think, were looking to New York as a little bit of a lesson on what the future looked like. And, you know, it really was, I think, telling because, you know, the lesson they shared was this is a lot harder than people think, reopening and, getting to the other side. And I think as a community and as a nation, we've certainly seen that. I think the other thing was, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about sort of what the similarities and the differences were and if there were, you know, any things that were working better or worse in communities. So, for example, in New Orleans, I mean, one of the really challenging issues was that this was just devastating to the lodging and hospitality industry, and that's their biggest industry. And you know, they were, you know, really sort of struggling with the financial impact of that. That industry is so intertwined with the nonprofit community. Almost every fundraiser is a party in New Orleans. And but it was, you know, it was having just devastating impact, and people were, you know, struggling to figure out, you know, how do you sort of reopen this critical industry safely. And New York, you know, they'd obviously just been so challenged in terms of their health system infrastructure. And, you know, they were beginning to see sort of what the financial impact looked like of having to suspend elective surgeries and other you know, other activities that normally produced revenue. I think a lot of us casually were thinking, oh, you know, hospitals must be doing, you know, at least okay financially. They're so busy. But, you know, the truth was they were getting devastated financially because they weren't doing some of the more, you know, the stronger revenue producing activities. And we, of course, you know, later saw that in both Detroit and New Orleans. So the other thing I think it was distinctive, you know, New York is, both of those cities are such big tourist destinations. Arts and culture is so critical, and you know, hospitality and lodging in New York, and sort of looking at you know, how that had been impacted. But I think the biggest thing was sort of recognizing that in those early days, I think we were all thinking maybe this was 4 weeks, maybe it was 6 weeks or a little bit more. I don't think most of us were thinking that we would still be where we are as we're getting ready to enter the month of August. So that was probably, I think, the real lesson from that conversation.
And when you think about this conversation, this statewide conversation that you facilitated, so was the rest of the state, I don't think I've discussed this with anyone sort of who sort of has sort of facilitated sort of a collective conversation. Was the rest of the state essentially experiencing COVID the same way, or was it a different experience? Because, you know, Detroit's a big city and you've got lots of smaller, more suburban rural areas around the state. Was everybody experiencing this all the same way, or were they very unique experiences? I mean, was comparing notes helpful, or was it just sort of being empathetic and encouraging or something?
Well, you know, it was interesting. The time that we did that conversation with chapters from around the state was, I think, a week or two after. Now, this received a lot of national publicity that a conservative groups stormed the Capitol building. Maybe everyone sort of uses different words to describe this, but there was a protest in Lansing of the governor's executive order to shut down. And there were some people there that were armed. It was a very divisive sort of moment in the state's response to COVID. And I think it was very clear to many of us that we were seeing something unusual, that normally disasters bring us together as a community and a state, and that in this instance, it was perhaps beginning to fracture us. I work for a nonprofit that has a very large presence in Southeast Michigan, but is based in Grand Rapids and serves the entire state. And we could see, I mean, we were being devastated here in Detroit, and it was having significant impact. We even lost a few lives of employees and residents. And then in other parts of the state, you know, that were more rural, it had really not, I think, had that kind of impact yet. It was a really interesting time to have that conversation.
And I'd just like to add that, but what I found when I participated in it is that we were all, as fundraisers, still thinking about the same issues, right? There was still, even though the pandemic was hitting differently, we had a statewide executive order, stay-at-home order, right? So we were all dealing with the same issues professionally in terms of how do we engage with our donors and prospects, and what do we do about our fundraising events, and what's going to happen when people just stop giving? You know, there really were a lot of the same questions because of the stay-at-home order. Wouldn't you agree, Steve?
There were. I mean, in the earliest days, I think our biggest concerns, maybe because we didn't realize how long this was going to be, you know, almost all the questions were about fundraising events. Mm-hmm. You know, oh my God, we're going to have to cancel our golf outing or our dinner. And everyone was worried because they might be losing, you know, depending on their size, a $20,000 or $200,000 event. And, of course, you know, that would eventually become, you know, the least of the problems around fundraising. But then over time, I think the questions evolved beyond events to, you know, how are you staying in touch and engaging donors? And then even on the, and sort of as we began to be able to, sort of see light at the end of the tunnel, how do you start to re-engage donors? We're actually going to be having a webinar soon with some organizations about that very topic. How do you reopen? And, you know, one of the panelists is a CEO who ended up hospitalized with COVID. Another is an organization that put together this very well-documented plan for how to safely engage donors because many of their donors are elderly and frail and obviously vulnerable to COVID. So, you know, it's just, it is interesting how that that dialogue has sort of changed. But I have to tell you, you know, Jason, if there's one sort of important lesson that came out of this, I think in the early days, we all thought, you know, the sky is falling regarding fundraising.
Yeah.
And which was interesting because in the earliest days, we were so focused on, you know, on the special events aspect. The truth is, I think anecdotally, and I think over time this will bear out in with data, is that philanthropy ended up being one of the most resilient streams of revenue for nonprofits. That the nonprofits that we saw that were being hurt the most financially were often the ones who had some form of earned revenue that was suddenly shut down. For many organizations, you know, philanthropy remained pretty consistent, or if the organization had pivoted and was making a really strong case for the work they were doing in response to COVID, they actually saw an increase. Mm-hmm. And of course we saw some organizations that sort of immediately, you know, cut back on investment in fundraising or even furloughed fundraising staff. And I think as fundraising professionals, we all tell people that we think that's a mistake, but I think that we witnessed that. That I think was one of the most important lessons is that even in this very complicated sort of unprecedented disaster, fundraising and philanthropy sort of became our saving grace and something that we could lean on and rely on.
So if there's anything, because of the read that you've sort of got in a very large city and with multiple large cities and certainly with your statewide conversations, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on sort of two observations that I think I'm sort of drawing. A lot of the input that I get, I'm sort of drawing from these podcast conversations. The two things I keep hearing, Diane and Steve, is I get a sense that there's sort of a reality check with the special event and that the virtual event sort of became a sort of a very quick pivot to sort of put in its place. But I kind of wonder if the virtual event is actually going to sort of begin to play a role, like we're finding ways to sort of be creative with the virtual event that'll stick even as we sort of resume our event planning sort of activities. The other thing is I'm hearing a positivity, or I think the word I heard this morning as we were reflecting on this is the idea sort of a revival or a redeeming of the telephone. I'm hearing that we can once again pick up the telephone and actually get the donor on the other end of the phone. What's your thoughts on either of those observations?
Steve, can I jump in here?
Yeah, absolutely, Diane.
Two things. One, I'll start with the phone. I've actually found that because people are at home, that my phone calls, like, they're picking up and they're lasting. The conversations are lasting much longer than anticipated, right? Because people want to talk to someone else. They're excited to talk to you. It gives them a break in their day. That's not something I expected, right? I was started out thinking, oh, this is going to be really challenging. Are donors and prospects still going to be willing to talk? And how are we going to do that? It's actually, I'm not having any problems getting phone calls or even virtual meetings. And I've just most recently started to visit people in person outdoors, like for coffee. Really, I leave it up to the individual donor to decide if they want to do that. And often they'll suggest it. I won't be the one suggesting it. But I'm finding and this could be common for many fundraisers, is that those type of meetings, I'm really focusing on people that are visiting or happen to be, maybe they're what we call snowbirds in Michigan. They live part-time in Florida and part-time in Michigan. People that I might normally go and visit in Florida or California or somewhere else in the United States. If they're in Michigan, then I'm trying to visit with them in person because I don't know when I'll have the opportunity to visit with them in their home states in the future. So other than that, I mean, it's been a lot of phone and video meetings. But I think definitely if there's an opportunity to meet someone who is from out of the area, a donor, a prospect, in a safe way, I'm starting to do that pretty regularly. As far as events go, one of the things that Steve and I had talked about is that if there were existing events that could be turned into virtual events and people were renewing their revenue, those have been successful. I think some of them, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future, but for events that nonprofits had already planned and had already secured sponsorships, a lot of those events went forward in a virtual way, and they were people, the sponsors were saying, well, I've already committed, just, you know, keep the revenue and that type of thing. Going forward, I suspect that trying to start a new virtual fundraising event could be challenging because then you're trying to secure new sponsorships, right? They're not saying, well, I've already committed. We at University of Michigan have really been focusing on virtual events as engagement opportunities more than fundraising opportunities. So it's a way for us to, we've been looking at it two ways. It's a way for us to engage a much larger group of our audience, of our donors and prospects, when we're doing more like a webinar or a lecture series. And that's been really helpful, more so than I think we were a little nervous at first, right? And then the other thing we've been doing is to do these small personalized events where we invite a small group of, like, you know, maybe 10 or less major gift prospects or donors, and have them meet with leadership to talk, you know, hear from leadership or answer questions like a Q&A with the dean or with our chancellor or president. So there's these two different ways to approach virtual events, but they're not necessarily direct what we would think of a typical fundraising event, but rather the engagement that would hopefully continue that relationship and lead to gifts down the road.
Jason, my view on this, on virtual events, may be a little contrarian to, you know, and I agree with almost everything Diane just said. I may be a little contrarian with some fundraisers today. I think there is an over fascination with virtual events and looking for some sort of magic, box solution. Yeah. When I looked at the questions from our discussions in the first fully two months, and it still is probably one of our most common questions, what's your best solution for virtual events? How do I do virtual events? And I would explain, you know, that for most organizations that aren't running mega events, that you probably could use your existing website and Zoom or any number of out-of-the-box Skype, any number of solutions. Or you could just spend time on the phone talking to donors. I mean, a lot of organizations simply pivoted and said, instead of doing an event that nets $50,000 to $100,000, I'm going to spend a lot more time on the phone and on Zoom meetings or Skype meetings with our donors. And I'm going to put a little bit more effort into email and other types of communication. And I'm going to get a little bit more creative in the use of technology and video. I'm going to go out and I'm going to talk to, I'm going to, you know, t- talk safely to people that are in the field and being impacted by this, and they had better results. I mean, sometimes maybe the gross results weren't as high, but the net results were more effective, and they didn't have to invest in an expensive solution. Now, clearly, there are some people, like we have a group here in Michigan, our local Muscular Dystrophy Association has been doing for years this incredible event and auction that the automotive industry is just hugely supportive of. Well, that was such a big event. Obviously, they needed to sort of make a pivot and use a fairly sophisticated online system. But I think there was just such a fascination with that. I think for all of the, there's obviously we spent a lot of time talking about technology and fundraising, and we've certainly made improvements. But frankly, I'm not impressed that we had done enough, and that when you get beyond, there's some organizations that have been great innovators, and then there are others that are still far behind. I mean, I was amazed, so many people seem to view, video conferencing like it was a technology that had just been invented in the aftermath of the pandemic. Right. And they would have, and I'm not sure why they weren't using this. I'll tell you something. In the early 2000s, I was vice president at Lawrence Tech University, and we won the AFP International first award for innovation in online fundraising. And I will tell you that it is not much more, we haven't progressed what we were doing much from that to where we are today. I think what we're going to see is, certainly there will continue to be some standalone virtual events that they will have some lasting impact. I think what we're going to end up with, and I think we're going to see this in the way we do professional development, is more of a hybrid, there will be some times that we'll choose to do something completely virtually, but more often than not, I think there's going to be a mix where maybe we use virtual to promote an event, to allow the event to engage more people beyond those that are there that night, to maybe allow the event to live on further beyond that single night. But I think that's going to be the real solution is how do you bring all these things together so that people can view them and participate in them the way they want to.
Well, Steve, if anybody wants to live up to the definition of contrarian, it's me. there's a story. I've repeated this, I think, once or twice already, but I think it's sort of along the line of sort of your observation, Steve. So there was a gentleman in New York City who's in the event planning business, and he's in the AFP circle and stuff. And he published about a 5-minute. Bear with me here. Let me get this straight. He published about a 5-minute video on YouTube that basically described himself as having lost his superpower. And this was right after COVID-19 sort of shut everything down. And I thought it was pretty profound in the sense that this is a guy who's an event planning guy, and he's saying basically, COVID-19 took away my superpower, and now I can't do these things for people. I can't help organizations raise money. And it sort of begs the old management question of being able to put down your tools. And I kind of wonder if COVID-19 is sort of creating this opportunity for us to put down some of our tools that haven't worked really well for us, or we've been using them too long, or maybe our identity is too wrapped up in them, which is sort of along the lines of what I think you're saying, Steve, is that our tools are not what is a fundraiser and not necessarily what makes a fundraiser. And because I my reaction to this guy was, shoot, if your identity is really just if your superpower is just putting on events and you don't know how to raise money any other way, then I get it. But I think as us as fundraisers need to be able to say, hey, the 400 people that came to my event last year, same event. Yeah, I can pick up the telephone. I can engage them in very meaningful ways. And I can ask them to renew their support. And I don't know why that wasn't sort of conveyed. This isn't what he does, but I felt like he was sort of missing the maybe just a better definition of what it means to be a fundraising professional.
Jason, I totally agree with you. There's lots of conversations going on that we're having about what virtual events we should or should not be doing. And I am saying it during those discussions at work that the most important part of an event, whether it's virtual or in person, is the ability to do follow-up, right? You want a great event, but it's the ability to follow up. So now people are thinking, oh, we could do so many more virtual events. And my response is, at least for the my area and the donors and prospects that I'm managing, is I have to look at my capacity to do follow-up, to invest in that relationship. And I can only do so much. I'm one person. And so I might push back and say, I'm really being specific about and looking at, okay, if I'm going to commit to an event, how much time do I have to do the work that really needs to be done, which is that investing in the relationship and the follow-up. And if I don't have the capacity to do that, then I don't want to do an event, because then I don't feel like I'm doing my fundraising work well, right? I think that's one of the lessons learned that became really clear in all the conversations that Steve and I had with people, is that investing in those relationships and engaging donors at this time is more important than ever. But it takes time. And as I said earlier, the prospects and the donors, most of them have time. And so it's taking even more time. And so I really am trying to help my fundraising team understand, while some of us have the capacity to engage those people after the event, others of us do not. And so we need to be really thinking about whether it makes sense for us to do an event or a virtual event or not. Perhaps it doesn't make sense to do it if we can't do the follow up well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your comment about, you know, losing your superpower, I mean, that story, I think that you're right on target. That, you know, I think one of the takeaways from the last few months is clearly that the importance of moving towards being a comprehensive and mature fundraising program, one that is connecting with donors in the way they want you to connect with them. I mean, I still work with donors, I'm sure you do, that love nothing more than getting a personal letter, and that's how they want to respond. Yeah. Now, we shouldn't be doing direct mail today the same way we did it 20 years ago, but we probably should be mailing to some donors. And, but I think one of the organizations that were impacted the most in some cases, you know, or most fearful about the impact were those that, you know, that were sort of one trick pony. The more comprehensive development program knew they still had assets and tools available to them. I think the other broader takeaway from some of this is that, as much as we've advanced in the use of technology in fundraising, I don't think our profession has been nearly as innovative as we may sometimes pat ourselves on the back for. We compare even today online giving to online retail. We are so far behind. And there are some organizations that have done some great things, but I don't think we've been nearly as creative. And in a lot of areas, I think our culture has created resistance. You know, the last few months have taught us things about working from home and job sharing that a lot of organizations just couldn't get beyond culturally. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how some of these things that nonprofits have been slow to embrace impact our profession. Are we willing to, you know, are more organizations willing to accept flex time, job sharing, work from home, and just innovation in general?
Yeah, I agree. The other thing is that for me, it's almost back to the basics, but it's not necessarily what other people think is the basics, but investing in those relationships. I keep talking about that. For me, it comes down to, what do my donors and prospects want in terms of communication, right? Whether they prefer the phone, whether they prefer video, whether they prefer Facebook, it's really, they're driving, as they should be, the way that we communicate with them. And so it's different for different people. And I think that that's the other thing that, this is really, the pandemic has really brought to light, is that we can't, it's just not, one thing doesn't work for everyone. And we need to really pay attention to that now more than ever.
Yeah. So one of the things that's always bugged me, talk about being contrarian here. So, you know, the statement that we always make in fundraising, the idea that fundraising, the essence of fundraising is all about relationships, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah. And it frustrates me when I hear someone say that in our field, because I always want to say, okay, now tell me what that relationship actually looks like. Because some relationships are not all that healthy. And some aren't necessarily good relationships. You know, you can have a very poorly designed and completely dysfunctional relationship. And I think the essence of fundraising at its best is really a conversation. And I think perhaps, and this is what I was, when I asked the question about the telephone, I think part of what the sort of maybe the silver lining in COVID-19 is that we've started to have more meaningful conversations with our donors. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Are we sort of realizing what, and I guess sort of a continuation of that thought is the idea, are we as fundraisers sort of realizing what it is our value is, or are we thinking more critically about what our value is to the organization? Because, for example, if one of our tools stops to work for us, like if we can't put on this event, and if perhaps virtual events aren't necessarily the way to go, we do have to have something else to offer our employer. And so we put ourselves in a bind, you know, when we talk about a labor market, if the skills that we bring to the table are very limited. And I want any fundraiser, whether they're my guest or a listener or anyone, certainly anybody, a member of AFP, to know that your ability to have a conversation with someone is really the value that we create. And you know, to sort of guide and carry that conversation along to the place where they can make a meaningful gift.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I the AFP Greater Detroit chapter has a really robust mentorship program for people who are newer to the field or wanting to come into the field, a fundraising field. And I'm a mentor, and I had this conversation just recently with my mentee about the fact that this is about conversations, and that when I go into any conversation, whether it's in person, phone, or video, I'm always thinking of what are the one or two things that I need to get out of this conversation, or that I would like to achieve out of this conversation, that will move the relationship forward towards a gift, right? So I think conversations are critical, and I was explaining that to her, and you know, someone who is, she's worked in annual giving, has not worked in major gifts, but is interested in major gifts and planned gifts. And sure. So it was really for her, it was like, okay, you know, that eye opener of, oh, so it's not enough just to call and pick up the phone, and to really think strategically about when we're interacting with our donors and prospects and having those conversations and identifying what is it we need to know in order to move that move forward towards a gift. And I think, I think there's still a lot of opportunity for fundraisers to understand that, and opportunities to bring people along in understanding that. I mean, one of my pet peeves is, you know, I do know some fundraisers that become friends with donors, and then they get to the point where they're not comfortable asking that person for a gift. And that's, I think, the unhealthy relationship that you're referring to. And yeah, in my role, I'm always very clear about why I'm calling, why I want to meet with someone. You know, if the conversation is going to be about philanthropy, about in general, am I going to ask them for a gift? I think I really believe in being very upfront and almost what people talk about permission-based fundraising, is really being clear about what my role is always with every single one of my donors and prospects, so that we don't somehow slip into an unhealthy relationship. We can be very friendly, and we can be have great conversations. But for me, in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, what do I need to learn today? And how does that weave into the conversation?
You know, Jason, you had a lot of really important thoughts in those last comments of yours. I think you raised the issue of, you know, our importance to our organizations and our colleagues. And I think that, you know, where that stands right now, you know, after this experience with COVID, and I also have to say, you know, we're talking a lot about the pandemic, but I think that a lot of this is equally true for some of the issues that are shaping up around racial and social justice too. And I don't think you can really, I mean, I think in here in Detroit, I might add, you know, I think the issue of the racial disparities regarding the impact of the pandemic were just exceedingly clear, you know, because we're a fairly, you know, segregated metropolitan community. And there was such a disproportionate impact on the African-American community in the city of Detroit. We began, you know, having some of the earliest discussion about how COVID was hitting, you know, the poor and minority communities differently. But so it's hard to completely separate those discussions. But I think that I have to say, I think that our colleagues, I mean, those outside of fundraising in the nonprofit sector, are kind of all over the map about this. You know, I have talked to some colleagues who said, yeah, my boss called me really angry and wants to know why we haven't gotten more of that COVID money. You know, and I'm, you know, and I, well, you know, and, you know, and it might be a nonprofit that had absolutely nothing to do with the response to COVID. And, you know, I think that we're dividing into these nonprofits that are what you call them haves or have nots, or those who get it and those who don't. There are some organizations like, you know, Diane works at the University of Michigan, a phenomenally successful fundraising organization with incredible professionals and some, you know, and great resources and experience and some of the best donors in the country in higher ed. And then there are other organizations that have for many years existed on government contracts, a lot of social service organizations in particular. And they realize that those contracts aren't as generous as they have been. And then something like COVID hits and has even greater impact where those contracts don't cover the increased costs. And there's just this expectation to say, well, I hired a chief development officer. Now, I may not have funded the development department extremely well, and I may not have given them much runway or tools, but, you know, fix this, you know, fix the, you know, the problem in my, the hole in my budget. And, you know, we know that it's not that simple, but I think that we're seeing a growing division between these types of organizations. Some of it, I think, is because there are, you know, and a number of groups, you know, the Ballmer Group and the Kresge Foundation have studied, you know, the recent impacts on government funding around social service and human service organizations. And they are seeing a growing gap that somehow needs to be filled by philanthropy. And yet most of these organizations don't have great experienced philanthropy programs or even necessarily CEOs and boards that have experience with philanthropy. So I guess it's a probably lengthy way of saying that I think that there's been very different responses to this. And I think it's put lots of pressure in some organizations on fundraisers. Some organizations have seen how the teams have responded and how they've helped bring new resources to address these challenges. And others, I think, just keep saying, hey, you know, you're the fundraiser, fix our problem. And you know, you can't fundraise your way out of a broken model.
Right. And I think, gosh, Steve, you and I could have a lot of fun. Diane's been in my seminar. So, we all think very much alike. But I have to ask this question because it's kind of the culminating question, sort of with all the observations that we've made. The other thing that I'm sort of feeling, and I these aren't the people, my podcast guests, because they're not necessarily, you know, very open about it on the podcast, but I am sensing, and I've gotten the calls, I think there's going to be a lot of movement. And what I mean by that is I think people are going to start switching jobs. I think perhaps sort of along the lines of what you're saying, Steve, is there's perhaps a more enlightened, maybe a more discerning fundraiser than we had, you know, among some of us. We might be more discerning and thinking more critically about the role that we play and maybe even the way in which, and this is always my hope, the way in which the organization is sort of setting us up for success. And so I'm curious, do the two of you sort of anticipate some of the movement that I'm sort of anticipating, or do you think people are going to stay put?
We're already seeing it here. I mean, couple of months ago, we had an all-time low for number of jobs advertised on our career center. Today, we're pushing an all-time high. I looked at a couple of other job sites and the same thing. And I think it's a couple of things. I think some organizations made rash decisions to furlough even fundraising staff. I think that some open positions were frozen in throughout the early days of the crisis. And then I think other organizations have seen that philanthropy has perhaps been one of the more resilient sources of revenue with an opportunity to grow, where earned revenue in some programs is still, you know, really impacted. I think that's created opportunities. I've seen other, you know, one of our colleagues was, you know, they did a massive cut at a local health system, and, you know, she found a job as a chief development officer 6 weeks later without a lot of, a really, you know, quick move. And so we actually did a program last week called Career Transitions in a Time of Pandemic.
Yeah.
And it was just really interesting, you know, listening to some of the people that were participating in the webinar. I think that you're absolutely right. Right on target.
I kind of wonder if some of the impulsivity that's almost like built into what it means to raise money, both on the giving and receiving side, is sort of, I hope to think that some of that can sort of be worked out during times like this, because I think we, you know, impulsivity on the part of the donor giving and impulsivity on sort of making decisions works in a very sort of predictable world. But when you're talking about a very complex and messy and, you know, things like COVID show up that you could not predict, being impulsive about your decisions just doesn't work.
No, I agree.
But we were talking sort of about this overarching issue of sort of lessons that we learned during this experience. And I think perhaps the most heartening one, and one that I just really encourage our colleagues, you know, particularly, I know that, you know, I, obviously those on the front line of caring for individuals and on the front lines of dealing with some of the racial and social unrest, those are the true heroes out there. But in both of those areas, you know, a lot of that work is made possible by professional fundraisers and volunteer fundraisers. And let's not forget them. And they've been under incredible, stress and pressure. And I think it's a really important lesson for us just to remember that facing these two very different challenges, you know, as a country, philanthropy and nonprofits are at the intersection of the solution. And, you know, sometimes we get so focused on, you know, numbers and meeting fundraising goals and what did this appeal, you know, what were the results mm-hmm. of this appeal, that it's easy to overlook the larger role that we play. And I think that's the part that I don't think I've ever been more proud to be a fundraiser. And I've just been so encouraged to see the way people helped each other out within our profession. I mean, of course, we all, you know, people volunteered and did amazing things. But within our profession, people were just so willing to share information to say, you know what, I am really busy delivering food and taking care of people. But, you know, yeah, I'll do your webinar. If I can share information that helps my colleagues, absolutely, I'll find a way to squeeze it in. I don't think I had a single person turn me down over the last few months. And I know that they were all overwhelmed with their own challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think COVID has proven to be an opportunity for, I have students over at the college that I teach a nonprofit course to, and often I say to them, you know, it's at times like this where the nonprofit sector can really shine, where we can show up, you know, and I think along the lines of everything that the two of you have shared today, that's the silver lining in all this, is where we've been given opportunities to really show up and not sort of beat ourselves down for not being able to, you know, do business as usual when certain tools aren't working for us and so forth. Diane and Steve, if somebody is listening to our conversation, they know how to find me, but if they want to reach out to you, continue the conversation with either of you, or perhaps learn some more about the Detroit AFP, how would you suggest that they do that?
The easiest way to do that, I think, would be to, and Steve, if you have another idea, I think is to just go on the internet, search for AFP Greater Detroit Chapter, and then you could look under About Us and the board, and we have all of our contact information available there.
Our organization, AFP Detroit's email is info@afpdet.org. And if they email that, they'll direct it to our chapter administrator. Will be glad to forward that to any of us. I'm certainly glad to provide my email. It's sragan@hopenetwork.org. But we'd love to hear from any of your listeners, and certainly love to hear about their own experiences too, and any feedback they might have.
Yeah. And I'll make sure to put some information about your chapter in the show notes. It sounds like you guys have compiled some pretty valuable resources over the last several months. So we'll make sure to get that in the show notes. Diane and Steve, you're always welcome back. All you got to do is have a big idea or bold opinion about the fundraising profession. Thank you for spending the afternoon with me.
Thank you.
And we're looking forward to having you visit our chapter soon. Face-to-face meetings, but right. if that's too long, maybe you can join one of our virtual programs.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.